Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 14.
Hey everyone, on today's show I talked to Isaku Kageyama, one of the top taiko drummers of his generation, and also the tables get turned and I get interviewed by Bad Communication Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome to Tokyo Podcast episode number 14. I am your host, Anthony Joe. And I am really excited about today's show. Actually, I say that every time, don't I? I'm always excited about the shows. Actually, I really enjoy doing the podcast, so I'm excited about every show. On today's show, I'm going to be talking to a gentleman named Isaku Kageyama, who is one of the premier taiko drummers of his young generation. I'm sure you know what taiko is, but in case you don't, it's those huge Japanese drums that you sometimes see in musical performances. And it's really, really spectacular performance to see because these drums are massive, the sound is awesome, and Isaku is one of the best at it. And as a matter of fact, he was the first taiko drummer to be accepted to an American university based on taiko. So I'm going to be talking to him a little bit later on the show about what it's like to be a young taiko drummer, what it's like to do that in the States, and kind of what the future holds for taiko. So it should be a lot of fun. But first, I wanted to mention that it is cold in Japan. I guess it depends on what part of the world you're listening to the show in, but I've spent the last 3 years in Thailand, and the coldest I ever got in Thailand was 22 degrees centigrade for a couple of days, but the average temperature in Thailand is about 30 to 35. So it rarely ever gets cold there. And that's been my experience for the past, few years. And so to come to Japan now and experience, 8 degrees, I'm actually surprised kind of how cold I am considering I'm from Canada. And when I lived in Canada, I was rarely ever affected by the cold weather. I owned an auto detailing business. We're dealing with water and, washing cars in the middle of winter wasn't really that big a deal. I remember actually the very first location that I opened was in like this really kind of, wasn't a rough part of town, but it wasn't the best part of town. And we didn't really have the car wash area sealed off as best we could. And what used to happen in the wintertime is the water would actually freeze to the cars. So that was a lot of fun. We used to actually wash cars with the cars running just to keep them warm to prevent the water from freezing. So I'm used to cold weather. It doesn't really bother me, but I'm really surprised how cold I am here in Japan. So what I've done is I have taken the great advice from my good friend Ashley, who runs the website survivinginjapan.com, and she has a really fantastic blog post about 8 ways to winterize your Japanese apartment. Because I gotta say, these Japanese apartments, there's not a lot of insulation in these things. When you turn on the heater, it's warm when you turn it on, but literally within seconds of after you turning it off, it feels cold again. And I guess it's just because the walls and windows and everything are so thin that the hot air just escapes outside. So I went over to Ashley's blog and I've got my place sealed shut. I've got this bubble wrap on the windows. I don't really know if it helps, but it I guess it does. I've got stuff under my doors. Everywhere that I can feel a draft, I've tried to seal it all up. And I even bought these heavy curtains from Nitori, and they actually, I think they're working really well. So if you got a cold apartment and you want to kind of warm it up a bit and winterize it, head over to Ashley's website at survivinginjapan.com and check out her 8 ways to winterize your Japanese apartment. Something else I wanted to mention was that I was recently interviewed by the guys over at Bad Communication Podcast. Their website is bc.wanwan.fm, and this is a weekly video podcast produced by three gentlemen who are living in Japan. And what they do is they cover all sorts of topics about life in Japan, news in Japan, what's going on, and they also have guests on the show. And it's a video podcast, a little bit different format than mine. So it was a lot of fun to to do it. They actually do a live show as well. So that was kind of interesting where they take feedback from the audience. And on my show, we had a couple Canadians who were sending in feedback from the very cold part of Canada called Winnipeg, or as it's nicknamed, Winterpeg. So if you want to check out that video interview with myself, I will post a link to that on my website at tokyopodcast.com, and you can see me in video. It was kind of funny to read actually one of the comments that someone said that I don't look like I sound. They, I guess, had a totally different image in their head of what I look like, which once again kind of surprised me, because when I was in Thailand, I also did a video series in Thailand. I think I made about 70 videos. And at one point, the videos were quite popular, and I used to get recognized on the streets of Thailand. It was really cute. Thais would come up to me, and even if they didn't speak English, they would just say video, and I knew what they were talking about. So it was kind of amusing for me to read these comments that I look different than I guess I sound. So if you're kind of curious as to what I look like, or you want to check out the very excellent Bad Communication podcast, visit their website at bc.wanwan.fm. And like I said, I'll also embed the video on my site at tokyopodcast.com. And lastly, I wanted to thank everyone who left feedback or comments on the Tokyo Podcast webpage on iTunes. I always appreciate that, because it does help. Although I did notice that for whatever reason, my ranking actually went down. I went from like 131 to 150. So I'm not really quite sure what's going on there. But keep leaving feedback or comments anyways on iTunes, because it is supposed to help. But I don't know, maybe it doesn't. But I always appreciate hearing back from the audience. If you do want to get a hold of me, you can do so through my website at tokyopodcast.com, or you can visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/tokyopodcast. And if you have an interesting website or a story or a business and you want to have it featured on the show, feel free to contact me. Many people ask me where I find the guests from, and a lot of it comes from either just searching myself, but some of the more interesting guests that I've had have been results of the audience members emailing me in. I remember when I was in Thailand and I was doing Bangkok podcast, one of the more interesting guests that we had on the show was a gentleman named Jerry Hopkins, who is an rock and roll autobiographer. He wrote the autobiographies of Jimi Hendrix, Elvis Presley, Jim Morrison from The Doors. He also was a writer for the Rolling Stones. And I never knew he lived in Thailand. And until some of the audience members started emailing us and said, hey, why don't you guys get this guy on the show? And I emailed him, and it was great. He came on the show, and it was really interesting to talk to a guy who was right there during the rock and roll revolution in America. So if you're interested in checking that out, that's episode number 26 of Bangkok Podcast. But I always enjoy hearing from the audience, because they usually come up with the best suggestions for guests. So if you do have a suggestion or comment or feedback, feel free to send it to me at tokyopodcast.com. My guest today is one of the premier taiko drummers of his generation. Isaku Kageyama is two-time national odaiko champion, becoming the youngest person to win this honor. His sound is strongly rooted in Japanese music, but he adds elements from jazz, rock, Latin, and African music to produce a powerful groove that goes far beyond traditional taiko. Hey Isaku, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So tell us, for people who are maybe kind of unaware, your start in taiko wasn't your choice, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was my parents that forced me to do something Japanese.
Because you were born in America, right?
Yeah, I was born in San Francisco, and I moved to Tokyo when I was 4.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to international school. So I didn't really have a strong connection with Japanese society or Japanese culture.
Even though you were living in Japan?
Yeah, I mean, if you go to international school in Japan, it's kind of like you become a part of the international community as opposed to the Japanese community.
Right.
So, I mean, you could go through a whole day without talking to a Japanese person.
So your parents said, enough of that. We don't want you becoming a gaijin.
I think they didn't want me to become whitewashed.
Right.
You know?
What was it like in the early days learning how to play taiko? What were some of the difficulties that you had?
Man, when I was little, I didn't understand why I had to do it. So I just hated it.
Right.
You know? And it would be stuff. I mean, school would start at 7 or 8, I think, elementary school.
Right.
And my dad would take me to the park or like the playground of my elementary school. And we would sit there for an hour or something and practice like these rhythms, these patterns,
yeah,
taiko patterns, like dodotsk, 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 like very rudimentary patterns. But I mean, those are like the fundamentals of taiko, and we would be doing that for like a half an hour, an hour every day.
Wow.
And, you know, as a little boy, I didn't really understand. I was like, no, dad, I want to play baseball.
I want to watch cartoons.
Yeah.
Did your dad have a background in music?
He plays guitar.
Okay.
Yeah. And he also plays percussion these days.
Right. So then, at what point did you start to kind of come around and go, hey, you know what, maybe this isn't so bad?
I think when I won the Odaiko contest when I was 18,
yeah,
I started to think about possibly making it my profession. I think, so I started playing when I was 6, and to about the point where I was like 16, I really didn't like it. I didn't enjoy playing taiko.
Wow.
And then from 16, I started to understand a little bit more about taiko, I think, and starting to take it a little bit more seriously.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't really, it wasn't fun, like, as in playing a video game or something, but it was something that I took seriously and that I wanted to get better at.
Right. This was at 16?
Yeah, 16 or 17.
So this is before you won the championship, right? What caused that shift in your thinking?
I think it's because I realized that taiko was something I had that other people didn't have, and it's something that gave me confidence in myself.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't really something that was fun, but it was something that I had.
Something that you were good at.
Yeah, and I wanted to polish that and make it better so that, you know, Because I would go to like a party or something, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I usually feel uncomfortable at parties.
Right.
But I noticed that because I was better at taiko than anybody else in the room, that kind of gave me a confidence to hang out.
Right.
So I guess taiko had become a part of me. And I wanted to develop that aspect of myself.
But you're studying now in America, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I'm in the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
And what's interesting is that you were the first taiko drummer accepted to this college, is that correct?
Yes.
But they don't have a taiko program, right? How did you get accepted to the school?
Well, they have an audition process that to figure out who they wanted to accept, and they had auditions in Nagoya, so I went from Tokyo to Nagoya and I brought my taiko with me.
Oh yeah
and I had called the school and asked, you know, I played taiko for like 20 years and I wanted to know if I can audition on taiko. And they told me, no, you have to audition on drum set or marimba or hand percussion, or, you know, something that we know, that something that we can assess whether or not you're good at.
Right.
You know, and so I practiced drum set every day for a month. But I also brought taiko with me.
Right.
And when they said, okay, next person, come on in, I brought the taiko out and I set it up and I said, hey, you know, I played taiko for 20 years and I played drum set for 1 month. So which do you want to hear? But it's all, I said that I think it's only fair that you let me show you what I can do on the taiko.
Right.
And don't just judge me on the drum set alone, you know. And they said, okay, we'll go ahead and you can play. And, you know, I played. And they said, so do you want to show us how far you got on the drum set in 1 month?
So obviously they accepted you. And how long have you been studying there now?
I've been here 6 months.
Yeah. But you're not studying taiko right now, right? You're studying...
Yeah, I'm studying hand percussion, so like a lot of the Latin stuff, right. Like congas and bongos and shakere and maracas and those kind of things, salsa music.
Are studying these other forms of music influencing the way you play taiko drum?
Yes, but not in the way that a lot of people would imagine. Like, I don't play Latin rhythms on the taiko. I think the big influence has come from how Latin music has fused with jazz or rock.
Mm.
Before I knew, I guess, the fundamental aspects of rock or jazz, kind of like what rock sounds like or what jazz sounds like.
Right.
But I didn't really understand the Latin aspect of it, what kind of rhythms were being used where, like what was being added and what was being subtracted to create Latin jazz or Latin rock.
Mm.
Like, I didn't really understand that, but I think studying the Latin aspect and then seeing, oh, okay, so you took A and you took B and then you made C.
Right.
Before, it was, I only knew the result and one of the ingredients, but I didn't know what the other ingredient was.
Right.
I think by studying Latin music, I can kind of deduce how they created Latin jazz or Latin rock. And I think that's really important because I want to apply the same kind of logic to create like a new Japanese music.
New Japanese taiko music or new Japanese music in general?
So, like, on my new CD, we're playing almost all the songs are traditional Japanese folk songs.
Right.
That come from, like, do you know what a bondori is? Have you been at a bondori?
What's that?
That's this festival in August, late August, where where your dead ancestors come back.
Okay.
And then there's a festival that honors your dead ancestors, and that's called the bondori.
Okay.
So they have like these folk songs that are played at the bondori. And on this CD, what we're doing is we're playing the folk songs, but we're playing with a rock feel or a jazz feel.
Oh, okay, okay. How does that go over with the traditional Japanese audience? Do they like the change? Are they hesitant about it? Do you get any like feedback? Resistance from people saying, ah, you know, like Elvis Presley when he started, a lot of people saying, ah, you shouldn't be taking that gospel music and mixing it with black music. You get a lot of people saying, I don't know, Isaku, this is tradition.
I think what we're doing is a little too tame to get that kind of pushback.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not really that big of a musical experimentation, I don't think, at this point. I mean, it sound because the point was to create music that sounds good.
Right.
It wasn't really to push the boundaries or, you know, that wasn't really the goal of this particular project, is to create good sounding music using traditional motifs, I guess.
Right.
So I don't think I'm getting too much pushback from the traditional audience. I think the biggest pushback is from people not being able to understand what it's going to sound like.
Hmm. Do you think that, you know, you'll see more Japanese, like traditional Japanese musicians doing what you're doing, trying to combine other forms of music into their art? Like, will you see more moving out of Japan, studying overseas?
I think a lot of Japanese musicians are trying to do that. Combine Japanese music with Western music, with rock or whatever. But the problem is that I don't think they really know how. Like I was talking about with the Latin music, where you need to know both of the ingredients in order to know the outcome.
Right.
I think a lot of Japanese musicians, like Hogaku, traditional Japanese musicians, they understand the Japanese music aspect, but they don't really understand rock or jazz, right, or Western harmony and how that works. So the thing that they produce is never greater than the sum of its parts. Like the product that they end up with is, I wish I could have heard them separately.
Right, right.
You know, right. I like rock and I like Japanese music, but I don't like the two combined together. Right. You know, that's usually what you end up with. It's like, you know, I want my hamburger and my ramen, but not my hamburger in my ramen, you know?
Like you said, sometimes you want your spaghetti and ramen separate.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is? Is it because they're studying only in Japan, so that they're lacking the influence from and the ability to study from around the world?
I think that's part of the reason. And the other reason is this structure of the structure within Hogaku, the structure within traditional Japanese music, like how people learn and how they develop as musicians, that whole process, I don't think is really encourages this kind of like creation of new music.
Right. I mean, it's very strict. It's very rigid. This is the way we've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Yeah. To some extent that, and for example, if you look at the sheet music for taiko.
Yeah.
It only makes sense to other taiko drummers.
Okay.
Like if you showed it to a flute player, the flute player wouldn't know what's written there.
Right.
And if you took a flute, the sheet music for the flute, and you gave it to a koto player, the koto player wouldn't know what to play.
Right.
And so then, you know, how do you create a band, you know? And it's very hard to play that kind of music, you know?
Right.
Because the infrastructure is just not really there.
Right. So do you think you'll see more Japanese musicians studying overseas?
Okay. In order for a traditional, like a Hogaku musician to become, to make a living, he kind of has to inherit his teacher's position.
Oh yeah.
To do it the quote unquote correct way.
Right.
You know, and let's say your teacher's 50 right now.
Mm.
Then technically your teacher would probably live for another 20 years.
Right.
So you would kind of be waiting in line for 20 years.
Right.
And you know, I mean, of course, that's a route that a lot of people choose because it's stable.
Right.
You know, if you wait for 20 years, then you'll make it.
Right.
You know, but a lot of musicians don't choose that route because, like, let's say you're not the son of your teacher, and there's five students. You don't know which one is going to get picked.
Okay, so there's a lot of waiting around. You can't really strike out on your own, is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, let's say you had a teacher, and there were five really strong students of that one teacher, right?
Mm.
If you were the son of the teacher, then you know you already got it made because you know your father's going to pick you,
right?
But let's say all five of you guys are unrelated to the teacher.
Right.
Right? Then you don't know who's going to get picked or who's not going to get picked, you know? And rather than you kind of waiting around to get picked, why don't you just, you know, do something on your own and, you know, try to create something on your own, you know?
Right.
And I think the system the Japanese system that, or the Hogaku system that's in place now, kind of encourages this waiting around. And I think the system is encourages you to find things to do while you're waiting around.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like you should study the traditional music in depth.
Right.
You know, and not necessarily to expand your horizons.
Right.
To play with as many different people as you can. You know, that's kind of the other extreme, you know?
Right.
I don't think there's necessarily a correct or like a right or a wrong way to go about this.
Right.
But I think a lot of people that thought that, you know, waiting around is their only option, I think they will choose to try and make it on their own when they see that is a choice that they have.
Right. When they see people like you who've taken a music that in America they didn't really know about, like the school, and become a success at it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you then, when you tell people in America that you play taiko, what is their response? Do they know what it is? Are they surprised? How do they react to it?
Well, I've been mostly around musicians, so like I guess 80 or 90% of the people know what it is.
Right.
Is
it popular in America?
Yeah, I think so. What would you base popularity on, though?
I just mean, like, are people familiar with it? You know, like, do they understand it? Do they, like, when you tell them, like, you know, many times in America, people have these kind of images of Japanese things that are, like, really old, you know? Mm-hmm. So they're surprised when young people are doing it. Because they think that whatever that is, it's associated with, like, old traditional Japan.
Right, right.
You know, like kendo or anything. They're like, wow, I didn't know young people did that. Like, they just have this stereotype of everything in Japan is super old.
Mm-hmm.
So when you tell them, hey, yeah, I play taiko, are they like, wow, cool. You know, where can I go see that? Or are they like, really? I thought your grandfather did that.
Oh, no. They're like, wow, cool. You know, like, let's jam.
Right.
And I think, you know, you were talking about popularity.
Right.
I think it's a lot easier to get a paying gig as a taiko drummer than it is as a drum set player.
Really, eh?
Yeah. Because there's just so many good drum set players out there.
Right.
And the paying gigs for that kind of thing is there's quite few of those.
Mm.
But if you're a good taiko player, then, you know, there's hardly any competition.
Right.
So I think it's a lot easier to get paying gigs as a taiko drummer than it is as a percussion or as a drum set player.
And are your shows different than what a traditional taiko show would be like?
Yeah, okay. Let me kind of elaborate on that. Because the idea of playing taiko on stage is only about 50, 60 years old.
Right. What was it originally used for? When did they originally play it?
If you look back in the history, the earliest evidence of taiko is from Jomon Yayoi period.
Okay.
Which is like 14,000 to 300 BC. I don't really know how, like, what exact point they found the evidence.
Right.
But I guess it's kind of like this clay pot kind of thing that they found. Okay, wait, don't quote me on this. The evidence is from Jomon Yayoi period, which is like prehistoric.
Right.
Where they found evidence of these taiko drums. So we know that the drums have been around for quite a while and that they've been used in war.
Oh, yeah.
To signal armies.
Right.
And that they, from being used in war, they came to be used as like religious rituals.
Right.
And then from then, they became used in theater. Okay. Like no and kabuki.
Right.
And from then, they became used as like contemporary music instruments. The last phase of the contemporary music phase is only 50 or 60 years old.
And this is where they started to kind of come into their own and people would go actually see taiko performances.
Right, right.
They weren't accompanying a kabuki play or something like that. They were on their own.
Right, right. It wasn't part of a matsuri. It wasn't part of a festival. It was It was like at a concert hall playing taiko. Yeah, that's only 50 or 60 years old.
Mm. Is it always the same number of drums? Do people use different number of drums, different size of drums, depending on however they feel like?
Yeah. I think there's a trend these days to make the show a little bit more elaborate.
Right.
And I think that's the influence of Broadway, Blue Man Group or Stomp or Blast or those kind of percussion-based Broadway shows.
Right.
I think they're having an influence on taiko, and taiko's using a lot more stage props and lighting and kind of the transitions between songs are becoming a little bit more staged.
Right.
I think that's the direction of taiko in general, to make it more of like a stage production.
What do you think about that? Because that's obviously quite different than what the traditional play was like, right?
What do you mean?
You as a musician, but also a Japanese, what do you think about this trend of pushing it towards kind of more of a Broadway style, getting away from the traditional Japanese display or performance of taiko?
Well, I'm a taiko purist, even though the whole concept of being like a taiko performance is only 50 years old. I'm still kind of a purist, and I think that when you concentrate more on the stage production aspect, you kind of lose the concentration on the actual technique of playing the instrument itself.
In your shows, so what do you do in your shows? Are they quite traditional? Do you have a latex blue mask that you wear?
No, I don't. Maybe I should get one though. I guess the thing that's different about my shows is that it's not kumidaiko. Kumidaiko is the whole idea of playing taiko on stage 50, 60 years ago, from 50, 60 years ago. That is using multiple drums and having multiple drummers perform on stage.
Okay.
That's like the kumidaiko. So when a lot of people imagine a taiko performance like 10 people getting on stage and playing really loud.
Yeah.
That's kumidaiko.
Okay.
And the roots of my taiko drumming is kumidaiko. But now I'm playing more, as a solo musician, I guess.
Now you're coming to Tokyo in January to give some performances.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you playing?
I'm playing at a couple small clubs. One is at Koenji Moon Stomp on January 5th.
I'm
also playing January 15th at Shibuya Shoto Salon. And I'm playing January 18th at Mandala in Minami Aoyama.
Who are your audience that comes out when you play in Japan? Is it a younger crowd, older crowd?
The age is quite varied, but I think it's usually the international crowd.
Oh yeah, not the Japanese crowd?
No. I don't think Japanese people can relate to my music, to be honest.
Really? It's too strange to them? Sounds too different?
I think if you were a Japanese born and raised in Japan, you would want to listen to either pure rock or pure Japanese music.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, let's go to the kabuki theater, or let's go to the opera, or let's go hear Sting or whatever, but let's not go listen to this combination of the two.
Right.
And the people that really appreciate that kind of the combining of the two cultures are, I think, the people who have seen both cultures.
Right.
And can kind of see the elements from each one coming together.
Right.
I think you need to be able to see both sides in order to think that the equation is, in order for the equation to make any sense or for it to be interesting to the audience,
Right, right.
So a lot of the people that come are, either Japanese that have lived abroad and then came back to Japan, or people who are born overseas and then they're living in Japan right now.
And will you be playing songs from your new CD at these events?
I will be playing some of the songs, but unfortunately not with the band that I recorded the songs with.
And your new CD is called Hybrid Soul.
Yeah,
and when is it coming out?
It's actually already out on CD Baby.
Okay.
But it's not out on iTunes or Amazon. We're working on that.
Okay.
But should be out by the end of January.
But you're offering people a chance to get a free track, is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. If you're interested in hearing what my weird music sounds like.
Hidden Gaijin music sounds like.
Yeah. And you can send me an email and I will send you a track to listen to. And the track is yours to keep. And, you know, please share it with your friends and talk about this thing that you listen to.
Wow, a musician who actually encourages sharing. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's how... And I think that's the direction that music is going towards, you know?
For sure. I hope so.
Yeah.
Well, if people want to find out more about your performances and location, dates, and as well as check out the free CD, they can visit your website at isakukageyama.com.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, Isaku. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you and learning a little bit more about the history of taiko.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks again to Isaku for coming on the show. If you are interested in finding out more information about his schedule here in Japan, check out isakukageyama.com. And on his website, you can check out his tour schedule and also enter your email to receive a free track from his newest CD. If you're interested in checking out my video interview with the guys over at Bad Communication, their website is bc.wanwan.fm, and I am episode number 71. And besides interviewing me, we talked about McDonald's skimping on French fries, the auto show, the world's most expensive car crash, and some of these really funny vintage Tokyo subway posters. So it's actually a really good show. I recommend you check it out. And I will post links to both those sites on my website at tokyopodcast.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.